Nietzsche wants to liberate those who can become exceptions to human mediocrity. In this godless world, he's convinced that the destiny of humanity depends upon the attainment of its highest type.
There is among men, as in every other animal species, an excess of failures. The successful cases are among men too, always the exception. And in view of the fact that man is the as yet undetermined animal, the rare exception. But still worse, the higher the type of man that a man represents, the greater the improbability that he will turn out well. The accidental, the law of absurdity in the whole economy of mankind, manifests itself most horribly in its destructive effect on the higher men, whose complicated conditions of life can only be calculated with great subtlety and difficulty.
Nietzsche's idea of higher humanity is quite complex, involving traits not found in ordinary people. He describes it as a union of spiritual superiority with well-being and an excess of strength. Higher human beings stand out because they're not only the strongest, but also the most spiritual. They have the richest and most complex natures. Their higher form of being translates into higher forms of culture. They can undertake great ventures and overall attempts of discipline and cultivation. And through these efforts, they can further enhance life. Nietzsche, therefore, considers such human beings to be higher in value than others, and so to be worthier of life. He maintains that human beings have value only for what they can do, what they can contribute to enhancing life. This has some sobering consequences.
Here, we must beware of superficiality and get to the bottom of the matter, resisting all sentimental weakness. Life itself is essentially appropriation, injury, overpowering of what is alien and weaker, suppression, hardness, imposition of one's own forms, incorporation and exploitation. Not from any morality or immorality, but because life simply is will to power. Exploitation does not belong to a corrupt or imperfect and primitive society. It belongs to the essence of what lives, as a basic, organic function. It is a consequence of the will to power, which is, after all, the will of life.
But this is only part of the story. These expressions of the will to power may be basic to all life and development, but they don't define what Nietzsche means by higher humanity. Only when the expressions take certain forms can they contribute to a richly flourishing culture. Nietzsche's entire concept of higher humanity relates directly and intimately to culture and its significance. Only culture and the creativity it involves can render human life meaningful and worth living. Otherwise, our existence is as bleak and senseless as Schopenhauer says it is. So in his early book on Schopenhauer, Nietzsche proposes what he calls consecration to culture as the only way we can justify and affirm life in the post-Christian world.
Anyone who believes in culture is thereby saying, I see above me something higher and more human than I am. Let everyone help me to attain it, as I will help everyone who knows and suffers as I do. The men we live among resemble a field over which is scattered the most precious fragments of sculpture, where everything calls to us. Come, assist, complete, bring together what belongs together. We have an immeasurable longing to become whole. The individual has to employ his own wrestling and longing as the alphabet, by means of which he can now read off the aspirations of mankind as a whole. But he may not halt even here. From this stage, he has to climb up to a yet higher one. Culture demands of him not only inward experience, not only an appreciation of the outward world that streams all around him, but finally, and above all, a struggle on behalf of culture. and hostility towards those influences, habits, laws, and institutions obstructing his goal, which is the production of the genius.
In later writings, Nietzsche replaces the genius with the overman as the symbol of vitality and creativity. His concept of the higher type of human being also reflects this new ideal. It points to what Nietzsche calls the great conception of man, that man becomes the transfigurer of existence when he learns to transfigure himself. This is how mere life is transformed into culture. Nietzsche would free those with exceptional abilities from the bonds of conventional morality to live beyond good and evil. They would not indulge their every desire, nor would they regress to the level of the subhuman beast of prey. For them, the commonplace controls and regulations of conduct would be replaced by the more severe self-discipline that creativity requires.
Many chains have been laid upon man so that he should no longer behave like an animal. And he has, in truth, become gentler, more spiritual, more joyful, more reflective than any animal is. Now, however, he suffers from having worn his chains for so long, from being deprived for so long of clear air and free movement. These chains are those heavy and pregnant errors contained in the conceptions of morality, religion, and metaphysics. Only when this sickness from one's chains has also been overcome will the first great goal have truly been attained, the separation of man from the animals. We stand now in the midst of our work of removing these chains, and we need to proceed with the greatest caution. Only the ennobled man may be given freedom of spirit.
Nietzsche's picture of higher humanity has much to be said for it. His higher human beings have overflowing vitality, great health, and powerful drives. They're highly spiritual, with refined sensibility and manners. They think and act independently. They're intellectually honest and astute. They're strong, undaunted by suffering and disillusionment, and persistent in overcoming their human failings. They have the resources and determination for the most demanding tasks. They have the ability to esteem and, above all, to create. This combination of qualities, for Nietzsche, is the consummation of human existence, and it represents the greatest possible enhancement of life.
The attainment of this goal would require a different kind of spirit from that likely to appear in this present age. But someday, in a stronger age than this decaying, self-doubting present, he must yet come to us, the redeeming man of great love and contempt, the creative spirit whose compelling strength will not let him rest in any aloofness or any beyond. This man of the future, who will redeem us not only from the hitherto reigning ideal, but also from that which was bound to grow out of it, the great nausea, the will to nothingness, nihilism. This bell stroke of noon and of the great decision that liberates the will again and restores its goal to the earth and his hope to man, this anti-Christian and anti-nihilist, this victor over God and nothingness, he must come one day.
Nietzsche was preoccupied with the problem of morality throughout his life. His thinking about it is complex, to say the least. He calls himself an immoralist, to convey his deep hostility to the kind of morality taken for granted by most people, then and now. One of his favorite names for this type of morality is herd animal morality. Morality in Europe today, he says, is herd animal morality. But his larger purpose is to provide a positive alternative to it, and not merely to criticize it.
As we understand it, this morality is merely one type of human morality, beside which, before which, and after which, many other types, above all higher moralities, are or ought to be possible.
Nietzsche's critique of traditional moralities is one of the most important parts of what he calls his revaluation of values. He claims that previous philosophers have failed to recognize just how deeply questionable these moralities and moral values really are.
Their usual mistaken premise is that they affirm some consensus of the nations, or at least of tame nations, concerning certain principles of morals. And then they infer from this that these principles must be unconditionally binding also for you and me. Or, conversely, they grasp the truth that among different nations, moral valuations are necessarily different, and then infer from this that no morality is at all binding. Both procedures are equally childish. The mistake made by the more refined among them is that they uncover and criticize the perhaps foolish opinions of a people about their morality, or of humanity about all human morality, and then suppose that they have criticized the morality itself. But even if a morality has grown out of an error, the realization of this fact would not as much as touch the problem of its value. Thus, nobody, up to now, has examined the value of that most famous of all medicines which is called morality. And the first step would be, for once, to question it. Well then, precisely this is our task.
So Nietzsche poses two related but different questions. Under what conditions did man devise these value judgments, good and evil? What value do they themselves possess? He believes the answers have profound implications.
One has taken the value of these values as given, as factual, as beyond all question. One has hitherto never doubted or hesitated in the slightest degree in supposing the good man to be of greater value than those who are considered evil. Of greater value in the sense of furthering the advancement and prosperity of man in general, the future of man included. But what if precisely morality would be to blame if the highest power and splendor actually possible was never in fact attained? So that precisely morality was the danger of dangers. My demand upon the philosopher is well known, that he take his stand beyond good and evil, and leave the illusion of moral judgment beneath himself. This demand follows from an insight which I was the first to formulate, that there are altogether no moral facts. Moral judgments agree with religious ones in believing in realities which are no realities. Morality is merely an interpretation of certain phenomena. More precisely, a misinterpretation.
Nietzsche argues that moral judgments and principles are neither absolute nor matters of fact at all. There are many moralities in the world. None of them is true in any absolute sense, but they do play a real and important part in human affairs. They've significantly affected the course of human development. Many people believe that morality involves using their consciences to discover some absolute moral standard to identify their specific obligations. But for Nietzsche, this is an error, based on the false picture of individuals standing alone before God and receiving his commandments. Moralities, he argues, are fundamentally social phenomena. He says that the oldest moral judgments originated in the basic human tendency to suppose that whatever harms me is something evil, whatever benefits me is something good. This tendency was long ago given a social turn, aiming at preserving the community generally and protecting it from destruction. The moral person is now someone whose attitudes and behavior are sympathetic, disinterested, commonly useful, and social. But Nietzsche contends that only a narrow and petty bourgeois morality is concerned primarily with the most direct and immediate consequences of our actions for others. Such a morality is thought by many to be a high point of moral enlightenment, He views it very differently.
Behind the basic principle of current moral fashion, moral actions are actions of sympathy for others, I see a social impulse of fearfulness at work, which dresses itself up intellectually in this way. This impulse has as its highest, most important and immediate aim the removal from life of everything dangerous which was earlier associated with it, to which end everyone is supposed to contribute and make every effort. Consequently, only actions conducive to the common security and feeling of security are permitted to be accorded the predicate good.
Nietzsche says the prohibiting negative side of this morality reflects the fact that the more dangerous a quality seems to the herd, the more thoroughly it is proscribed or forbidden. Its positive prescriptive side commends all the herd thinks desirable. So Nietzsche remarks that in its morality, the herd animal thus glorifies the herd nature. Nietzsche thinks both sides of this morality are harmful when they're imposed upon potentially higher human beings. The ideas of the herd should rule in the herd, he says, but they should not reach out beyond it. So Nietzsche laments that all the forces and drives by virtue of which life and growth exist lie under the ban of morality. He finds little merit in life lived merely according to what the herd thinks desirable.
What in Europe today is called simply morality, as if there were no other morality and could be no other, is herd animal morality, which is striving with all its power for a universal green pasture happiness on earth, namely for security, absence of danger, comfort, the easy life. The two doctrines it preaches most often are equal rights and sympathy with all that suffers. And it takes suffering itself to be something that must absolutely be abolished. That such ideas as these are still modern gives one a bad opinion of modernity.
Reflecting on this morality's origin and its alternatives, Nietzsche presents his famous distinction between two fundamental original types of morality.
Wandering through the many subtler and coarser moralities, which have so far been prevalent on Earth, or still are prevalent, I found that certain features recurred regularly together and were closely associated, until I finally discovered two basic types and one basic difference. These are master morality and slave morality. The moral discrimination of values has originated either among a ruling group, whose consciousness of its difference from the ruled group was accompanied by delight, or among the ruled, the slaves and dependents of every degree. In this first type of morality, the opposition of good and bad means approximately the same as noble and contemptible. The opposition of good and evil has a different origin.
Nietzsche suggests that the second contrast of good and evil came into the world among slaves, who reacted against their rulers and everything associated with them.
The slave revolt in morality begins when resentment itself becomes creative and gives birth to values. While every noble morality develops from a triumphant affirmation of itself, slave morality, from the outset, says no to what is outside, what is different, what is not itself, and this no is its creative deed.
Slave morality, Nietzsche says, was shaped from the beginning by the fears and interests of people whose lives were miserable.
Suppose the violated, oppressed, suffering, unfree, who are uncertain of themselves and weary, moralize. What will their moral valuations have in common? Probably a pessimistic suspicion about the whole condition of man will find expression. Perhaps a condemnation of man along with his condition. Those qualities are brought out and flooded with light, which serve to ease existence for those who suffer. Here, pity, the complaisant and obliging hand, the warm heart, patience, industry, humility, and friendliness are honored. For here they are the most useful qualities, and almost the only means for enduring the pressure of existence.
Nietzsche believes that today's morality has grown from this slave morality, and he emphatically rejects it, at least for those who no longer need it.
This entire old morality concerns us no more. There is not a concept in it that still deserves respect. We have outlived it. We are no longer coarse and naive enough to have to let ourselves be deceived in this fashion.
Nietzsche also argues that modern morality, like the slave morality in which it originated, promotes values harmful to the quality of human life. He asks us to consider how man might be raised to his greatest splendor and power. He concludes that morality has been essentially directed to obstruct or destroy that splendid evolution wherever it's been going on. So Nietzsche vehemently opposes this familiar morality we've been taught to accept, even revere. It was once needed, he says, so that man might prevail in his struggle with nature and with the wild animal in himself. But to enhance life further, we must now emancipate ourselves from the narrow and fear-ridden bonds of morality. Yet not everyone should abandon this herd morality. It's well-suited to those who cannot be more than the herd type of human being, and Nietzsche would have them retain it. Only those capable of transcending ordinary humanity should live beyond good and evil, in Nietzsche's phrase. But to them, he says,
we should have profoundest gratitude for that which morality has achieved hitherto. But now, it is only a burden which may become a fatality. Morality itself, in the form of honesty, compels us to deny morality.
Nietzsche seeks not only to come to terms with past and present moralities, but also to look beyond them. He wants to change our understanding of morality and attempts to place it on a new footing. The first task of those with the finest and sharpest consciences today is to break the grip of traditional morality by subjecting it to radical criticism. But once we accomplish this preliminary task, another follows. Moral theory must be transformed. Nietzsche proposes to naturalize morality, recasting it in terms of what he calls purely naturalistic values. Moralities should promote the preservation, flourishing, and development of human life. Human beings have differing needs and abilities. Nietzsche argues that different moralities are appropriate for them. He advocates a form of moral pluralism. No single kind of morality will be best for all. A morality that's well-suited to some may be harmful to others. Yet Nietzsche wants moralities to do more than simply reflect the conditions of life of different sorts of people. They should also strengthen and enhance life more generally, maximizing the contributions each can make to this larger process. Nietzsche's higher moralities aren't the same as the original master morality he describes. Higher moralities may resemble this master morality in some ways, but they also differ importantly from it, just as Nietzsche's higher humanity differs from early barbaric humanity. These higher moralities would be appropriate for higher human beings generally, but they wouldn't all have the same content. So Nietzsche doesn't seek to establish some universal moral law or categorical imperative, as Kant had done. Nietzsche says we should limit ourselves to the creation of our own new tables of what is good in order to become human beings who are new, unique, incomparable, who give themselves laws, and who create themselves. These exceptional human beings would not merely assert their individuality. The higher morality they would live by is a form of discipline. It serves to train men for the heights. Ordinary morality, on the other hand, seeks only to make everyone both harmless and helpful to others.
All those who do not have themselves well under control and do not know morality as self-mastery and self-overcoming, constantly practiced in the greatest and smallest matters, come naturally to exalt the good, sympathetic, benevolent sentiments of that instinctive morality which has no head, but rather seems simply to be all heart and helping hands.
A higher morality of self-mastery and self-overcoming, like other moralities, involves restraint, resistance to impulse, prescription, and proscription. but it's also a means to an enriched, strengthened, refined, and more creative form of life. The challenge here is to give oneself a goal and to work out a way to achieve it. So Nietzsche calls for an experimental morality modeled on the more familiar idea of an artist's morality. Art involves creativity and innovation, and it attains varying forms and degrees of excellence. An artist's morality is the particular kind of discipline needed to cultivate and utilize the artist's abilities. The morality of Nietzsche's higher human beings is a generalized version of this morality of artists and creators. Their specific laws of life and action would reflect, serve their chosen goals. If they're subject to any general imperative, it's only to find some way of becoming the creators they can be. This is both their privilege and their responsibility. Self-overcoming, self-mastery, self-cultivation, and self-direction characterize them, and their higher morality as well.
Here, the greater, more manifold, more comprehensive life transcends and lives beyond the old morality. The individual appears, obliged to give himself laws and to develop his own arts and wiles for self-preservation, self-enhancement, self-redemption.
This higher morality is not a morality for everyone, as Nietzsche himself often reminds us. Yet he calls for it to supplant all more commonplace moralities among those who can do without them. This higher morality may seem to be no morality at all in the usual sense. It certainly goes beyond good and evil, as these terms are ordinarily understood. But Nietzsche insists that however disconcerting this may be, at least this does not mean beyond good and bad. Nietzsche's social and political views seem even more dismaying to many people than his ideas about morality, in part because they frequently are even more seriously misunderstood. They were horribly distorted by the Nazis, leading many people to mistake Nazi ideology for Nietzsche's own thinking. But he does reject democratic ideals that we tend to take for granted. Many people who are strongly attached to these ideals recoil from his challenge to them, misinterpreting both his criticisms and the alternatives he proposes. Nietzsche's real concern is not at all to demean and undermine humanity at its best. Rather, he wants us to appreciate what humanity at its best can be, and to understand what its attainment requires. So he attempts to replace pious illusions and naive beliefs with deeper insight and unflinching honesty. For example, Nietzsche says that war, conquest, exploitation, mastery, and domination are essential to life and its development. But this doesn't mean he endorses brutality and barbarism. He thinks it's naive to suppose human life could develop without conflict and competition for power in some form or other. But now that the key to the further enhancement of life is a flourishing and enriched cultural life, the forms of conflict and competition he welcomes are very different from those typical of earlier times. Nietzsche also insists that all enhancements of human life have been and always will be associated with aristocratic societies. But he doesn't advocate a new sort of caste or class system. His point is that human development always requires some way of accentuating human differences. Nietzsche's new nobility is not to be based on race or social class. Instead, the new order of rank he envisions would be a meritocracy, with people's rank depending entirely on their ability to contribute creatively to cultural life. Many thought that Nietzsche saw his fellow Germans as the very embodiment of higher humanity, and thought that they deserved to rule the world. But Nietzsche harshly criticizes the Germans.
Perhaps I know the Germans. Perhaps I may even tell them some truths. The new Germany represents a large quantum of fitness, both inherited and acquired by training. But it is not a high culture that has thus become the master. The Germans. Once they were called the people of thinkers. Do they think at all today? The Germans are now bored with the spirit. The Germans now mistrust the spirit. Politics swallows up all serious concern for really spiritual matters. Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. I fear that was the end of German philosophy. In the history of European culture, the rise of the Reich means one thing above all, a displacement of the center of gravity. It is already known everywhere that in what matters most, and that always remains culture, the Germans are no longer worthy of consideration.
Nietzsche also is often assumed to be a champion of the powerful national state and thus sympathetic to totalitarianism. But his Zarathustra portrays the state as a deadly danger.
Somewhere there are still peoples and herds, but not where we live, my brothers. Here there are states. State? What is that? Well then, open your ears to me, for now I shall speak to you about the death of peoples. State is the name of the coldest of all cold monsters. Coldly it tells lies, too, and this lie crawls out of its mouth. I, the state, am the people. That is a lie. It was creators who created peoples and hung a faith and a love over them. Thus they served life. It is annihilators who set traps for the many and call them state. They hang a sword and 100 appetites over them. Verily, this sign signifies the will to death. Verily, it beckons to the preachers of death. Only where the state ends, there begins the human being who is not superfluous. There begins the song of necessity, the unique and inimitable tune, the rainbow and the bridges of the overman.
Nietzsche is hostile to democracy because he believes it ignores human differences and hinders those with exceptional abilities. But if democracy's bias against merit can be resisted, he admits that there's something to be said for it after all.
In a certain sense, the exceptional human being can maintain and develop himself most easily in a democratic society. Namely, when the coarser means of defense are no longer necessary, and habits of order, honesty, justice, and trust are part of the usual conditions.
Finally, Nietzsche is commonly considered an advocate of war and military might. But a very different conclusion is suggested by his comment in The Means to Real Peace.
No government nowadays admits that it maintains an army so as to satisfy its occasional thirst for conquest. The army is supposed to be for defense. That morality which sanctions self-protection is called upon to be its advocate. This is how all states now confront one another. They presuppose an evil disposition in their neighbor and a benevolent disposition in themselves. This presupposition, however, is a piece of inhumanity as bad as, if not worse than, a war would be. The doctrine of the army as a means of self-defense must be renounced just as completely as the thirst for conquest. And perhaps there will come a great day on which a nation distinguished for wars and victories and for the highest development of military discipline and thinking and accustomed to making the heaviest sacrifices on behalf of these things will cry of its own free will, "We shall shatter the sword!" and demolish its entire military machine down to its last foundations. To disarm, while being the best armed, out of an elevation of sensibility, that is the means to real peace. Better to perish than to hate and fear, and twofold better to perish than to make oneself hated and feared. This must one day become the supreme maxim of every individual state.
Nietzsche champions neither Germany nor the national state, and he advocates neither war nor a return to some imagined state of nature. Above all else, he wants culture to flourish, and he's opposed to everything that threatens it by suppressing creativity. Nietzsche promotes the cause of transforming merely biological and social existence into a culture that continually promotes the expression of human ability. He envisions a higher humanity that sublimates natural drives into a higher spirituality, characterized by a wealth of creative activity. This is Nietzsche's vision of the enhancement of life, culminating in the flourishing of culture and symbolized by the Overman. These achievements manifest that fundamental human disposition he calls will to power, but they represent its most highly developed and demanding expression. Here, the will to power is no longer expressed in barbaric or tyrannical displays of strength and domination. The will to power is transformed in creative directions as new forms of competition and superiority appear, and art is Nietzsche's paradigm of this transfiguration of life. In his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche celebrates the culture of the ancient Greeks as one of humanity's greatest achievements. Through their arts, they overcame the terror and horror of existence. They discovered how life could be endowed with value. Art for the Greeks was a transfiguring activity of the highest significance, amounting to nothing less than the complement and consummation of existence. Nietzsche points to the Greeks to show us how the arts generally can make life possible and worth living.
We have our highest dignity in our significance as works of art. For it is only as an aesthetic phenomenon that existence and the world are eternally justified.
In his later writings, Nietzsche broadens his focus beyond art to include cultural life generally. Cultural life represents a larger scale version of what artists do in narrower contexts, using their creative powers to transform natural existence and to create new values. But Nietzsche reveres art because it's shown us the way. Our ultimate gratitude to art, he writes, is that it's taught us to be well-disposed to appearance and to what has been created.
As an aesthetic phenomenon, existence is still bearable for us. And art furnishes us with eyes and hands and above all the good conscience to be able to turn ourselves into such a phenomenon.
Art has served as a kind of special schooling of the human spirit. New capacities of expression have been cultivated, replacing the discipline society requires. Artistic creativity transfigures things, heedless of their original form. Nietzsche observes that, unlike men of knowledge who leave everything as it is, artists alter and transform. They teach us that there is no contradiction between relishing and embellishing life. And we learn from them that more is gained than lost by altering life's aspect. We're indebted to artists because their work takes us a crucial step towards transforming human life in such a way that all nature ceases and becomes art. So artists have prepared the way for a higher form of human life which would at once consummate and surpass art itself. Artists, for Nietzsche, are only an intermediate type, and art is but a preliminary state in relation to this higher concept of art in humanity. But that's not only the limitation of art and artists, it's also their great significance and their glory.
What one should learn from artists. How can we make things beautiful, attractive, and desirable for us when they are not? And I rather think that in themselves they never are. This we should learn from artists, while being wiser than they are in other matters. For with them, this